heard the story recently about a mother and daughter who were in their car getting ready to leave the Walmart parking lot, and they observed next to them another mother and daughter getting in the car, getting ready to leave the Walmart parking lot. And as the mother and daughter, one mother and daughter were observing, the other mother and daughter had an interaction like this. "I don't want to sit in my car seat." "You have to sit in your car seat." "No, I don't want to sit in my car seat." "You have to sit in your car seat. It's not safe for you not to be in your car seat." "I don't want to sit in my car seat." And the child broke into temper tantrums high and low. And as one mother and daughter watched, they observed the other mother finally break down and give in and say, "Okay, just this once," and put her daughter in the front seat. And as they drove out of the parking lot, the observing mother looked in the rearview mirror and noticed her child sitting in the car seat, deep in thought. After they had gone down the street a couple of stoplights, a little voice came from the back seat saying, "Mama, what was wrong with that other mother?" Now, as we've looked at the parable of the prodigal son over the last few weeks, we have noticed something wrong with the children. What is wrong with these sons? They don't seem to understand their father. They're selfish. They're self-centered. But I would like to ask the question this morning, what is wrong with this father? What is wrong with this father? Because as I read the story, there's always one thing that jumps out at me that I just cannot understand why any father in his right mind would do this. So let us look at the story once more. It's in Luke 15, starting with verse 11. Again, a very familiar story, and we just need to read the first couple of lines to get to this question of what is wrong with this father. It says, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So what did he do? He divided the property between them." Now, we noticed before something unusual about the son's request. Anyone remember what that is?
"We want it right now."
It is not normal to get your inheritance while your parents are still alive. And so we noticed that that sends sort of a nasty message to his dad. "Dad, I wish you were dead so I could have your stuff." But what is even more unusual to me is the father's response. How many of you, if you had a child come to you insolently saying, "Dad, give me 20 bucks, would give the child 20 bucks? I got at least one head shaking. How many of you would do that? If some kid came to you and said, anyway, we won't say what he said. "I want you out of the way. Give me your money." Good. No hands. If this had been me, I would have said something like, "No way. I'll give you an allowance, and maybe after you've shown that you can handle your finances, then we'll talk about doing something more." Right? Wouldn't you have thought that that would have been a more responsible thing to do with your money? Remember we'll come back to that in just a second. So why did the father give him the money? Now, I would love to just turn you loose and make you think about that for a long time, but I think I'm going to ask some intermediate questions that will kind of help us wander through that question. But that's the big question for today. Why in the world give this son all this money when it seems obvious to us, reading the story anyway, that this young man was not about to be responsible with it? In fact, he was likely going to go out and cause himself, at the very least, if not anyone else, a lot of trouble by how he handled it. All right, let's ask an intermediate question. Why give him the money? Well, what would have happened if he hadn't given him the money? Well, he might have left anyway. This thing is going nuts a little bit. Probably the battery's gone. Rather than fight with that, let me just do this. He might have left anyway. Why do you think that? Pardon? If he didn't get his way, yeah, he might just take off. We get the idea, based on his behavior, that he wanted to be somewhere else. Yeah. Now, so the dad could have made it as difficult as possible for him to leave by withholding the moolah so that he couldn't support himself out there on his own. But even if he did that, and even if that convinced the younger son to stay, what has the father accomplished? I see some heads shaking. What do you mean, Ken?
Coercion through strength.
All right. He has coerced his son into staying because he has the power and the son does not. All right? He has the resources and the son does not. Pardon? He pacify his son by not... Oh, right. Well, and that's the question. That's the question I'm raising. Did he just roll over and pacify his son and let him have the money? That doesn't seem like a very wise thing to do. But we're just considering the other side. If he had withheld the money in order to keep him there, would he have accomplished much? And the answer I'm getting back from you is, well, he might have had him there physically, but his heart still would have been in a far country. His heart still would have been in a far country. One person made a comment when I asked that question. The son probably would have stayed around. He might have stayed around, but he probably just would have leaned on his shovel handle a lot. Right? That's what you call passive resistance. He might have been there physically, but he wasn't going to be there emotionally. And I've alluded to this before, but like the little boy who his dad made him sit on the pew in church, and he wanted to stand up, and finally he muttered to his dad under his breath, "I may be sitting on the outside, but I'm standing up on the inside." Right? He could have kept his son at home physically. He would have been present physically, but that would have been about it. He would not have been there emotionally. How easily could the father have predicted what his son was going to do with the inheritance if he gave it to him? All right. At least last time as we were looking at that, we said this was not surprising, right, that he was going to take off and go waste his inheritance in a far country. So it's not like the father didn't know that he was going to do this. So why enable his son to leave, even though he knew he was going to be irresponsible, that he was most likely going to end up in a far country with all his money gone and all his friends leaving him, starving to death, feeding pigs, humiliated, ashamed, threadbare, hungry. Knowing what his son was going to do, why would he allow him, give him the power, really, even to do that? And let me ask this part of it, and then I'll back up again. What does it tell us about the father's view of pain and humiliation and hunger? They might be educational tools, Norm said. All right, very interesting. Ken, were you going to add something to that?
The dad could have said, "I'll give you $100 a week," and could have kept him for 1,000 years.
Interesting.
And he could have partied some
at $100
a week, but he went through his $1,000,000. Wanted it was gone, and he reaped the results.
That's interesting. I just read a story about a family that the son was irresponsible, and so they sent him to Australia. This was back almost in colonial days in Australia. They sent him to Australia on an allowance of, you know, so much a month, and he had to show up at the lawyer's office to receive it periodically, or he didn't get it. And the whole purpose was to keep him far away in Australia and basically make him dependent on that income because they knew he'd wasted. They just wanted to keep him alive and far away. so interesting. If the father had wanted to just keep him alive and far away, that would have done the trick. Obviously, he was after something besides keeping him alive and far away.
Or alive and close.
Or alive and close, as the case may be. Yeah. In this particular case, they were sending the money to Australia, and he had to be there to pick it up. Like you said, he could have given them an allowance. I hadn't thought about that when I said, well, I'll give you an allowance for a little while and see how you handle it, and then we'll talk. That could have easily turned into what you just described, the endless progression of get my check, go and drink it, come back, you know, get my check, go and drink it, be hungry for part of the month or whatever. A lot of people live that way in our world. Yes. It is a possibility that the son could have gotten violent, right? And in fact, it's even hinted at in the fact that he requests, while his father is still alive, his inheritance. The attitude is, get out of my way, I want your stuff. And so we don't know whether there really was fear involved, but there's certainly no reason to eliminate that possibility entirely. Let's back up from that. So, humiliation and pain and hunger are not the very worst thing in the world, right? They're bad, but they're not the absolute worst thing. So what is the worst thing? Sin? In this situation, for the father, what is the worst? In other words, he's willing to give his son this stuff knowing that he's going to go put himself through pain. But why is he willing to do that? What is he able to avoid, maybe? What is he trying to avoid, maybe? What is the worst thing?
Permanent separation.
All right. Permanent separation. And so your word sin is not far off. But in relational terms, the thing the father is afraid of most is losing that relationship with his son forever. And if there's any possibility that he can get that relationship, that heart relationship back, no amount of pain or humiliation or shame is too much is too big a deal. He's not afraid of his son going through those things. If there's any possibility of receiving him back, as it says later in the parable, safe and sound. Yep, very true. Where if he kept him at home forcibly, he won't let me do anything. Go ahead. You were going to make a comment.
It's another way of showing tough love, too.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it's a way of showing tough love.
He doesn't really want him to go, but there's no really way for him to control it either.
Well, yes, and that was what we said before. He could keep him physically, perhaps. He could lock him up if he wanted to. But does he really have him at home?
No.
No. Not at the level that matters to him, which is what level?
Spiritual.
Yeah, the heart level. The love level. He could physically keep him there. But say he physically keeps him there until the son gets old and gray and dies. Right? Now, assuming the father outlived him, that's neither here nor there for the moment. But assuming he could do that, he still... all he's done is ensure that his son will die estranged from him. And that he will be missing him forever. All right. How do I ask this? Let me ponder this a little bit more. Now you're in trouble. Well, maybe I don't need to ask it in so many words because you've already described this. The father's biggest goal is to have his son's heart, right? To have a love relationship with his son. Now, if we think about this in terms of us and God, why does God, what are some of the reasons why God wants a love relationship with us? Why is that so essential to God? Pardon? It's who he is, right? Good. He is love. Why else is it essential to him to have a love relationship with us? Maybe if you look at it from our perspective, what difference does it make to us whether we love God or not?
If we don't love him, we don't get saved.
So it's a pretty significant issue, isn't it? Right? This is life and death for us. Are you with me? If I am not in love with God, I cannot continue to live. Now, that's kind of a crazy thing, because you can't hold a gun to somebody's head and say, love me or you're dead. Are they going to, even if it's true, are they going to suddenly love you more because you pointed a gun at their head? No, but in some way, God is in that situation. Because if we don't love him, we're dead. So how does he communicate that with us? How does he deal with that issue that if we go far, far away from him to a far country and waste all our resources, we're dead? How does he deal with that without giving us the impression that he's got a gun to our head? I guess one way to look at it in this story is the transformation that takes place. When the son comes home, how does the father describe what has happened? Go back and look in the story. He was dead and is alive again, was lost and is found. And my question for you this morning is, when was he dead? Now, I'm not going to take answers immediately. I want you to consult with the person next to you. When was he dead? This is good. I hear consultations happening around the room. And have you settled it between yourselves when he was dead? How many of you and your cohort agree? Do you agree? That because the fact is, the son never does die in the story, right? He was at home and he goes away and he was starving. In fact, the son says, I'm dying here. And he comes home alive. So when the father says he was dead and is alive again, he's not, you know, we aren't looking for a chronological point in the story at which he actually passed away and was resurrected. So what does he mean, and at what point is it true that his son was dead? I bet Lou says when he asked for his part of the inheritance. What other insight? What did the rest of you say? Ken? All right, when he had the thought, he would be back even before he asked. Ken?
Died as he left the relationship with his father before he asked.
All right, we've backed up even more. The fact is, all of you have pointed to, he was dead at home before he ever left. All right, and we may not be able to put our finger precisely on when that happened. We certainly see the evidence of it when he actually opens his mouth and says, give me this stuff, I'm out of here. But he was dead before he... When I read the story and I heard that, you know, the father, he was dead, I always just sort of assumed, well, you know, he went away. I never thought I'd see him again. You know, my son is dead to me. He's gone. But this father recognized, I could keep him here at home. But he is dead to me, even here at home. And so it's not dumb to give him the means to go away if there's the possibility that hunger and pain and humiliation, thorns and thistles, uncleanness will cause him to come to his senses and maybe return home alive again.
When he made up his mind to start home, he was going to ask his father for a service job.
Yeah. When he came to his senses.
When he came to his senses. And when his father saw him coming, yeah. He didn't want to see him in his feet filthy rag. He put the his cloak on him.
So the transition from dead back to alive actually happened back there in the pigsty when he decided that he was willing to be his father's son again. Paul, what were you going to say? He was willing even to be his father's servant. Yes, Paul, you were started to make a comment. You remember what it was?
Because he felt like cast out.
You're saying, what question are you answering with that? I'm sorry.
Where God said the father, we feel like
I don't know. He might have felt like an outcast, but there's no indication from his father's perspective that his father didn't want him. The way the story reads, it makes it sound much more like the son wanted to get away from his father.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. A lot of times, when you just feel like cast out, you want to get away from everybody.
Yeah. But there's no indication that he'd been mistreated in any way by his father. He wanted to get away from his brother. I don't know. I suppose that's possible. Doesn't sound like a very pleasant brother to have around. Ed Reed, who's a stewardship author, suggests giving your kids their inheritance early while you can see what they're going to do with it. Because when you are dead and you leave a bunch of money or something to your kids, you have no influence or say or control about what they do with it. But you know what some have suggested, and I think is biblically defensible, is that you are still responsible for what somebody else does with resources that you collected if you just give it away to them without considering as carefully as you might have what they're going to do with it. Which is an interesting, it's an interesting challenge, that if I know, right, what my kids are going to do with the money that God has allowed me to earn over the course of my life, and when I die, I just leave it to them to go and drink and throw away. Is that practicing good stewardship? Certainly, it's not. Will God hold us responsible for stewardship, even if it is our last act of stewardship? I think so. And so there's good counsel in giving your kids their inheritance early, at least part of their inheritance early, to see what are they going to do with it. Because when you die, you're not going to see what they're going to do with it or be able to have any influence over that at all. So is that what this father is doing? Giving his son a stewardship test? Pardon, go ahead.
We've been traveling with some of the senior groups, you know.
Yes.
And one of them...
I'm spending my inheritance, my children's inheritance.
Exactly. People in it were quite wealthy, and their lawyer counseled them. Within 6 months, the kids go through the inheritance. They generally travel. So you travel and spend your own inheritance.
And I've seen that bumper sticker on the back of a lot of RVs.
I'm
spending my children's inheritance. And the reality is what Ed Reed is recommending is not so much that you just go waste it on pleasure yourself, but if you are a person who would like to see the cause of God supported, don't give it to your kids and expect them to support God's cause with it, because chances are when you're gone, they won't. You support God's cause with the resources that God has allowed you to accumulate over your life. And make that your crowning act of stewardship before you go, because you have some responsibility in what happens with that even after you're gone. And if you give it to someone who would not do what you would want to do with it, well, duh, why didn't you do it yourself before you didn't have any control over it anymore? Well, I think that is some of what's going on. Yeah. In this story, I think that is what's happening. But notice the other thing that we can learn from stewardship principles of giving your children their inheritance early. What if they go out and blow it and waste it? Yes, but in this story, what additional resource did the son have after he went out and blew it and wasted it? Isn't that interesting? He went back home to his father's house. Now, what if the father had waited until he died and then given this irresponsible son all the money? What would have happened then after he went out and wasted it in 6 months?
His cranky brother.
Yeah. What kind of welcome would he got at home with his cranky brother? Yeah. So interesting that there may be some wisdom in this giving out the inheritance early, even though this father, he didn't care about the money. Right? He gave all of his stuff between the two sons. But the fact is, he gave it early enough so that when the child came to his senses and decided to come home again, he still had a home to come home to. Perhaps something to learn from that. Were you going to make an additional comment, Monty?
How much did Jesus give to those that he knew were going to reject
him? Oh, my. Well, let's come back to that in just a moment. Let me see. Am I there yet? Are we at that point? Yeah, we're at that point. What does it cost to give someone an inheritance, typically? Yes. Corinne and I came back from seminary for Christmas 1 year to be with family and got a phone call. Would you like Grandma and Grandpa's big dining room table? And we became the inheritors of nice big dining room table. But what did that mean had happened?
Yeah. Someone passed away.
That my grandparents were gone. And I would have been glad to go out and buy a table and not have to pay the cost of losing the grandparents.
But what did that table mean to them?
Not an awful lot. It was just a table. Not an awful lot. I mean, I'm just saying, honestly, this particular, it's not that I needed that table, and it wasn't particularly special to me or to them. We just happened to, you know, need a bigger table, and suddenly here was one. And I was happy for the table, but not for getting it that way. But that's normally what an inheritance costs. So, essentially, when the son comes to his father and says, I want my inheritance, that's really fascinating, the word it actually uses. It says he divided his bios between them. Now, most of your translations will say his wealth. Some will say his living. But it literally says he divided his life between them. It cost him everything he had to give that inheritance to that son. And I think there's a picture here of humanity's attitude toward God. Right? Adam and Eve said, we want to be in charge now. What did Jesus tell them that would cost them? What did God tell them that would cost them back at the beginning? Yeah, it's going to cost you your life. But they didn't die, did they? Well,
yeah, they did, just like the prodigal here.
Yes, eventually they did. They did a lot of suffering.
They were dead in the garden.
They were dead before they left home, all right? But, in another sense, they didn't. You know what I mean? They could have. They were dead already to God in their hearts. They could have been dead physically in their bodies as well. But there's a phrase that's found two or three places in the Bible. One of them is Revelation, is it 8:13? Yes, thank you. That Jesus was the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. That in essence, God said, when Adam and Eve said, we want your stuff, not you, you know, we'll take the earth and everything and our lives and go away to a far country, but you can stay out of it. God, in order to give them that, in order to give them the opportunity to learn from thorns and thistles and pain and humiliation, just to give them the opportunity to do that, it cost him his life.
Cost his son.
And he committed that at the beginning, even though historically the event hadn't happened yet. God, in order to allow any of us to be born and breathe and eat and live and die, it cost him everything he had. Whether we come home or not, just to give us the opportunity to learn and live, to live and learn from our mistakes, cost him everything that he could give. So indeed, it's true. Jesus has given everything he could possibly give to those who would reject him. And the hope that some would come to their senses in a far country, in a pigsty, when they're hungry, and come home. No guarantees, only the hope. Essentially, God is saying to those who come to him and say, I want you dead, essentially he's saying, okay. The problem is he can't just leave, because the whole universe falls apart. God holds it all together. He can't give us anything without himself. It just doesn't work. But he's willing. If there's any way that God could just walk off of the stage of the universe and leave it all to us, he would do it. Just because we asked. Even if our attitude was wrong. But he can't. And so he tries to find a way to communicate that kind of love so that we might be able to come to our senses. So why give someone the means to hurt themselves and me? Does God have bad boundaries? Is he a doormat? Is he getting walked over? Karina said he knows that he is a greater resource. Yes.
He loves his son.
But he is being taken advantage of. Because that son, like I talked last week, that son went off in the full knowledge of who he was and his father's son. And he went off with all the education, all of the blessings, everything that his father could give him.
Yes.
He went off to do his own thing, but all the time he knew who he was, and he knew.
And here's the difference. Karina said, one reason God can do it is because he knows, yeah, it's not about the stuff, right? He's not worried about getting walked on because he can give and give and give, and he doesn't run out. But at another level, he's not getting walked on because he gives it willingly. Right? And people who are doormats and get walked on, they're afraid to speak up, they're afraid to stand their ground, they're afraid to do something else, and they resent it the whole time. That's not what's happening here. Right? He's giving willingly, freely, lovingly, because he wants to. Not because he's scared to do something else. But the other difference is this. It's not poor boundaries, it's actually the best boundaries, because he knows he cannot force anyone to love him. And so what he's doing is defining himself. I can love you no matter what you want to do to me. He's taking good care of himself that way. He knows what's his business and what's not his business. And he is giving other people the opportunity then to love him back because they want to. And that's the ultimate of good boundaries. is you deciding who you're going to love and not love, and letting other people decide whether they're going to love, who they're going to love and not love. And God could have made the reins a lot shorter. He could have kept the leash a lot shorter. But if there was any possibility that by giving us room to come to our senses, that we would, it's within His love and His willingness to do that. Jerry?
He made it free moral agency.
Yes.
And we have to choose.
Yes.
And we choose today to be served.
No. Yes, to be loved by a God like that.
That's why we're in this church today.
Amen. That's what it's about.
We made it possible for us to learn from our mistakes without leaving really any room open for us
to blame Him. Yeah. Of course, there's always room. You know, people always come up with some reason to blame God. And this, it took this son a while. I mean, he ran away from his father as far as he could go, fueled on what an awful dad he was and all the horrible things and all the restrictions that he placed on me when I was at home. But when he finally realized, this is my own doing, and looked back, he couldn't find anything to accuse his father of. My father's done nothing but give to me when I was unreasonable. And so then he was able to come to his senses, because there was nothing left to accuse his father of anymore. His father had let him do all the things that he had told himself. He'll never let me do this. He'll never let me do that. His father let him try all those things. And he discovered they weren't as good as he had expected them to be. Anybody else here discovered that? Anybody here tried a few things and discovered they weren't as good as you expected them to be? Pardon? No kidding.
Amazing thing to me is, you know, it says he came to his senses, but he was down and out, and he was hungry, and he was hurting, and he wanted something better for himself. But God, I mean, the Father took him back anyway. It didn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. The reality is,
why he was there.
Exactly. The reality is, he turned back to home, still not understanding his father, exactly. Still selfish, still interested in saving his neck, but willing to be loved by his father. That was the only thing that had changed. He was willing to be loved by his father. And the love can transform the rest of those things. When he arrived, the father was able to deal with some of his misconceptions right away. You think you're going to come back here as a slave? No way. You know, he was able to change some of those things. Ken?
The prophecy of Caiaphas was one man would die for the nation. And so the nation
even
had him crucified.
Even though Caiaphas's attitude was, we want him dead.
We want you dead.
But Jesus gave the gift of his life even to Caiaphas, even though what he wanted was murder.
You want your freedom? You want me gone?
Powerful.
You have the chance to come back.
Yeah. Yeah. And though I have my doubts about Caiaphas, the fact that Jesus died in his time and place so that he could see the Christian movement as it began, Caiaphas did have the opportunity to come to his senses in an amazing way that most people have not seen. Now, he was part of those events. Yeah. Jim?
The son was able to go back to his father and understand what the father was trying to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the fact that the other son wasn't willing to look at it that way.
Yeah, he still didn't understand.
It shows, in a way, who was more selfish.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. The one that we would look at on the outside as more selfish, now the one who actually ran off and did all the bad stuff, was not in as much trouble, really, at the heart level, as the one who behaved himself and stayed at home. Yes, very, very true. Well, because he's wasteful. Just like the prodigal son is wasteful. Do you see what I'm saying? The prodigal That's what the word prodigal means, is wasteful. He went out and wasted all that money on prostitutes. But the father was doing the same thing. He wasted all his stuff on his son. And on an ungrateful stay-at-home son, yeah. But the exciting thing, and this is what we just said, he did it willingly and gladly. And this is our God. He is prodigal. Right? He's extravagant in his love. He gives more than he needs to. You know, he didn't just say, okay, well, I'll give him $25,000 and that should be enough for him to learn his lesson. He divided his property, his life, between them. It was more than was necessary. But our God is wasteful in his love. And we need to learn from that. We need to be loved by a wasteful lover. And let him waste himself on us.